This is My Zine. Here's a story by Percival Everett, The Appropriation of Cultures. Daniel Barclay had money left to him by his mother. He had a house which had been left to him by his mother. He had a degree in American Studies from Brown University, which he had in some way earned, but had not yet earned anything for him. He played a 1940 Martin guitar with a Barkus Berry pickup and drove a 1976 Jensen Interceptor, which he had purchased after his mother's sister had died and left him her money, she having had no children of her own. Daniel Barclay didn't work and didn't pretend to need to, spending most of his time reading. Some nights he went to a joint near the campus of the University of South Carolina and played jazz with some old guys who all worked very hard during the day but didn't hold Daniel's condition against him. Daniel played standards with the old guys, but what he loved to play was old-time slide tunes. One night, some white boys from a fraternity yelled forward to the stage at the black man holding the acoustic guitar and began to shout, "Play Dixie for us! Play Dixie for us!" Daniel gave them a long look, studied their big-tooth grins and the beer-shiny eyes stuck into puffy, pale faces, hovering over golf shirts and chinos. He looked from them to the uncomfortable expressions on the faces of the old guys with whom he was playing, and then to the embarrassed faces of the other college kids in the club. And then he started to play. He felt his way slowly through the chords of the song once and listened to the deadened hush as it fell over the room. He used the strut to squeeze out the melody of the song he had grown up hating, the song the whites had always pulled out to remind themselves and those other people just where they were. Daniel sang the song. He sang it slowly. He sang it, feeling the lyrics, deciding that the lyrics were his, deciding that the song was his. Old times there are not forgotten. He sang the song and listened to the silence around him. He resisted the urge to let satire ring through his voice. He meant what he sang. Look away. Look away, look away, Dixieland. When he was finished, he looked up to see the room full of eyes on him. One person clapped, then another, and soon the tavern was filled with applause and hoots. He found the frat boys in the back and watched as they stormed out, a couple of people near the door chuckling at them as they passed. Roger, the old guy who played tenor sax, slapped Daniel on the back and said something like, "Right on," or "Cool." Roger then played the first few notes of "Take the A-Train," and they were off. When the set was done, all the college kids slapped Daniel on the back as he walked toward the bar, where he found a beer waiting. Daniel didn't much care for the slaps on the back, but he didn't focus too much energy on that. He was busy trying to sort out his feelings about what he had just played. The irony of his playing the song straight and from the heart was made more ironic by the fact that as he played it, it came straight and from his heart, and he was claiming southern soil, or at least recognizing his blood in it. His was the land of cotton, and hell no, it was not forgotten. At 23, his anger was fresh and typical, and so was his ease with it, the way it could be forgotten for chunks of time, until something like that night with the white frat boys, or simply a flashing blue light in the rearview mirror, brought it all back. He liked the song, wanted to play it again, knew that he would. He drove home from the bar on Green Street and back to his house, where he made tea and read about Pickett's charge at Gettysburg while he sat in the big leather chair which had been his father's. He fell asleep and had a dream in which he stopped Pickett's men on the Emmitsburg Road on their way to the field, and said, "Give me back my flag." Daniel's friend Sarah was a very large woman with a very large Afro hairdo. They were sitting on the porch of Daniel's house having tea. The late fall afternoon was mild and slightly overcast. Daniel sat in the wicker rocker while Sarah curled her feet under her on the glider. "I wish I could have heard it," she said. "Yeah, me too." Personally, I can't even stand to go in that place. All that drinking. Those white kids love to drink. Sarah studied her fingernails. I guess. The place is harmless. They seem to like the music. Do you think I should paint my nails? Daniel frowned at her. If you want to. I mean, really paint them. You know, black or with red, white, and blue stripes. Something like that. She held her hand, appearing to imagine the colors. I'd have to grow them long. What are you talking about? Just bullshitting. Daniel and Sarah went to a grocery market to buy food for lunch and Daniel's dinner. Daniel pushed the cart through the Piggly Wiggly while Sarah walked ahead of him. He watched her large movements and her confident stride. At the checkout, he added a bulletin full of pictures of local cars and trucks for sale to his items on the conveyor. What's that for? Sarah asked. I think I want to buy a truck. Buy a truck? So I can drive you around when you paint your nails. Later, after lunch, and after Sarah had left him alone, Daniel sat in his living room and picked up the car sale magazine. As he suspected, there were several trucks he liked, and one in particular, a 1968 Ford 3/4 ton, with the one thing it shared with the other possibilities, a full rear cab window decal of the Confederate flag. He called the number the following morning and arranged with Barb, Travis's wife, to stop by and see the truck. Travis and Barb lived across the river in the town of Irmo, a name which Daniel had always thought suited a disease for cattle. He drove around the maze of tract homes until he found the right street and number. A woman in a housecoat across the street watched from her porch, safe inside the chain-link fence around her yard. From down the street, a man and a teenager, who were covered with grease and apparently engaged in work on a torn-apart Dodge Charger, mindlessly wiped their hands and studied him. Daniel walked across the front yard through a maze of plastic toys and knocked on the front door. Travis opened the door and asked in a surly voice, "What is it?" "I called about the truck," Daniel said. "Oh, you're Dan?" Daniel nodded. "The truck's in the backyard. Let me get the keys." He pushed the door to, but it didn't catch. Daniel heard the quality of the exchange between Travis and Barb, but not the words. He did hear Barb say, as Travis pulled open the door, "I couldn't tell over the phone." "Got him," Travis said. "Come on with me." He looked at Daniel's Jensen as they walked through the yard. "What kind of car is that?" "It's a Jensen." "Nice looking. Is it fast?" "I guess." The truck looked a little rough, a pale blue with a bleached-out hood and a crack across the top of the windshield. Travis opened the driver's side door and pushed the key into the ignition. "It's a strong runner," he said. Daniel put his hand on the faded hood and felt the warmth, knew that Travis had already warmed up the motor. Travis turned the key and the engine kicked over. He nodded to Daniel. Daniel nodded back. He looked up to see a blonde woman looking on from behind the screen door of the back porch. "The clutch and the alternator are new this year." Travis stepped backward to the wall of the bed and looked in. "There's some rust back here, but the bottom's pretty solid." Daniel attended to the sound of the engine. "Misses just a little," he said. "A tune-up will fix that." Daniel regarded the rebel flag decal covering the rear window of the cab, touched it with his finger. "That thing'll peel right off," Travis said. "No, I like it." Daniel sat down in the truck behind the steering wheel. "Mind if I take it for a spin?" "Sure thing." Travis looked toward the house, then back to Daniel. "The brakes are good, but you gotta press hard." Daniel nodded. Travis shut the door, his long fingers wrapped over the edge of the half-lowered glass. Daniel noticed that one of the man's fingernails was blackened. "I'll just take it around a block or two." The blonde woman was now standing outside the door on the concrete steps. Daniel put the truck in gear, and drove out of the yard, past his car, and down the street by the man, a teenager, who was still at work on the charger. They stared at him, were still watching him as he turned right at the corner. The truck handled decently, but that really wasn't important. Back at Travis's house, Daniel left the keys in the truck and got out to observe the bald tires while Travis looked on. The ad in the magazine said 2,000. Yeah, but I'm willing to work with you. Tell you what, I'll give you 2,200 if you deliver it to my house. Travis was lost, scratching his head and looking back at the house for his wife, who was no longer standing there. Whereabouts do you live?
I live over near the university, near Five Points.
2,200? Travis said, more to himself than to Daniel. Sure, I can get it to your house. Here's 200. Daniel counted out the money and handed it to the man. I'll have the rest for you in cash when you deliver the truck. He watched Travis feel the bills with his skinny fingers. Can you have it there about 4?
I can do that.
What in the world do you need a truck for? Sarah asked. She stepped over to the counter and poured herself another cup of coffee, then sat back down at the table with Daniel.
I'm not buying the truck.
Well, I am buying a truck, but only because I need the truck for the decal.
I'm buying the decal.
Decal?
Yes. This truck has a Confederate flag in the back window.
What?
I've decided that the rebel flag is my flag.
My blood is Southern blood, right?
Well, it's my flag.
Sarah put down her cup and saucer and picked up a cookie from the plate in the middle of the table.
You've flipped.
I knew this would happen to you if you didn't work. A person needs to work.
I don't need money.
That's not the point. You don't have to work for money. She stood and walked to the edge of the porch and looked up and down the street. I've got my books and my music.
You need a job so you can be around people you don't care about, doing stuff you don't care about.
You need a job to occupy that part of your brain.
I suppose it's too late now, though.
Nonetheless, Daniel said, you should have seen those redneck boys when I took Dixie from them. They didn't know what to do.
So the goddamn flag is flying over the state capitol. Don't take it down. Just take it. That's what I say.
That's all you have to do. That's all there is to it.
Yep.
Daniel leaned back in his rocker. You watch old Travis when he gets here. Travis arrived with the pickup a little before 4, his wife pulling up behind him in a yellow Trans Am. Barb got out of the car and walked up to the porch with Travis. She gave the house a careful look.
Hey, Travis, Daniel said. This is my friend Sarah.
Travis nodded hello.
You must be Barb, Daniel said.
Barb smiled weakly. Travis looked at Sarah, then back at the truck, and then to Daniel.
You sure you don't want me to peel that thing off the window?
I'm positive.
Okay.
Daniel gave Sarah a glance to be sure she was watching Travis's face. Here's the balance, he said, handing over the money. He took the truck keys from the skinny fingers. Barb sighed and asked, as if the question was burning right through her,
Why do you want that flag on the truck?
Why shouldn't I want it? Daniel asked. Barb didn't know what to say. She studied her feet for a second, then regarded the house again.
I mean, you live in a nice house and drive that sports car. What do you need a truck like that for?
You don't want the money?
Yes, we want the money, Travis said, trying to silence Barb with a look.
I need the truck for hauling stuff, Daniel said. You know, like groceries and... He looked to Sarah for help.
Books,
Sarah said.
Books, things like that.
Daniel held Barb's eyes until she looked away. She watched Travis sign his name to the back of the title and hand it to him as he took it. He said, I was just lucky enough to find a truck with the Black Power flag already on it.
What?
Travis screwed up his face. trying to understand. "The black power flag on the window. You mean you didn't know it?" Travis and Barb looked at each other. "Well, anyway," Daniel said, "I'm glad we could do business." He turned to Sarah. "Let me take you for a ride in my new truck." He and Sarah walked across the yard, got into the pickup, and waved to Travis and Barb, who were still standing in Daniel's yard, as they drove away. Sarah was on the verge of hysterics by the time they were out of sight. "That was beautiful," she said. "No," Daniel said softly, "that was true." Over the next weeks, sightings of Daniel and his truck proved problematic for some. He was accosted by two big white men in a 72 Monte Carlo in the parking lot of a 7-Eleven on Two Notch Road. "What are you doing with that on your truck, boy?" the bigger of the two asked. "Flying it proudly," Daniel said, noticing the rebel front plate on the Chevrolet. "Just like you, brothers." The confused second man took a step toward Daniel. "What did you call us?" "Brothers." The second man pushed Daniel in the chest with two extended fists, but not terribly hard. "I don't want any trouble," Daniel told them. Then a Volkswagen with four black teenagers parked in the slot beside Daniel's truck, and they jumped out, staring and looking serious. "What's going on?" the driver and largest of the teenagers asked. "They were admiring our flag," Daniel said, pointing to his truck. The teenagers were confused. "We fly the flag proudly, don't we, young brothers?" Daniel gave a bent-arm, black-power, closed-fist salute. "Don't we?" he repeated. "Don't we?" "Yeah," the men said. The white men had backed away to their car. They slipped into it and drove away. Daniel looked at the teenagers, and with as serious a face as he could manage, he said, "Get a flag and fly it proudly." At a gas station, a lawyer named Ahmad Wilson stood filling the tank of his BMW and staring at the back window of Daniel's truck. He then looked at Daniel. "Your truck?" he asked. Daniel stopped cleaning the windshield and nodded. Wilson didn't ask a question, just pointed to the rear window of Daniel's pickup. "Power to the people," Daniel said and laughed. Daniel played Dixie in another bar in town, this time with an R&B dance band, at a banquet of the Black Medical Association. The strange looks and expressions of outrage changed to bemused laughter and finally to open joking and acceptance as the song was played fast enough for dancing. Then the song was sung, slowly, to the profound surprise of those singing the song. "I wish I was in the land of cotton. Old times there are not forgotten. Look away, look away, look away." Soon there were several, then many, cars and trucks in Columbia, South Carolina, sporting Confederate flags and being driven by black people. Black businessmen and ministers wore rebel flag buttons on their lapels and clips on their ties. The marching band of South Carolina State College, a predominantly black land-grant institution in Orangeburg, paraded with the flag during homecoming. Black people all over the state flew the Confederate flag. The symbol began to disappear from the fronts of big rigs and back windows of jacked-up four-wheelers. And after the emblem was used to dress the yards and mark picnic sites of black family reunions the following 4th of July, the piece of cloth was quietly dismissed from its station with the U.S. and state flags atop the state capitol. There was no ceremony, no notice. One day, it was not there. Look away, look away, look away. That was The Appropriation of Cultures, a story by Percival Everett, first published in Kalalu and republished in the 1998 edition of the Pushcart Prize, Best of the Small Presses. a little dry humor relating to the dispute in South Carolina about the Confederate flag being flown over the state capitol. I'd like to tell you about the Oregon Water Trust, and I'll do so by reading a piece from the fall 1998 edition of the Whole Earth Review. This was written by Seth Zuckerman. For a century and a half, water law in the American West held that you could only enforce your right to water if it was working for you, irrigating a field, for instance, or supplying a subdivision. If you preferred to leave the water in the stream and let it flow to the ocean, you were wasting it, and someone else could use it in your place. Leave it there for 5 years, and you lost your right forever. That notion started to crumble in 1987, when Oregon passed a law putting in-stream uses on a par with withdrawals. If you wanted to dedicate your water to the salmon and the salamanders, you could. It was as revolutionary as if forest owners were suddenly allowed to hold on to their land even if they didn't clear-cut. The nonprofit Oregon Water Trust arose to take advantage of this opportunity. It administers water rights that it leases, buys, or receives as a gift and makes sure that its water stays in the creeks and rivers. An acre's worth of irrigation rights are worth $500 to $1,500, making a total of $20,000 to $60,000 for every cubic foot per second left in the stream. Like a land trust, a water trust offers tax benefits to donors and embodies a modern incarnation of the commons, protecting natural phenomena that everybody's fish and living rivers depend on. Even more delectably, the 1987 statute extended another well-worn principle, first in time, first in right, to water dedicated to the cause of fish. Framers of water law always realized that flows fluctuate from flood to drought and gave senior rights holders precedence over newcomers if there wasn't enough to go around. Under the law, the Oregon Water Trust can trump the needs of irrigators if it owns an older right. That's exactly what happened on Sucker Creek in southwestern Oregon. Even before the trust was formed, a landowner was willing to donate his 1857 rights to help rebuild the faltering runs of Steelhead, Chinook, and Coho. But junior water rooters, users upstream were taking the water before it reached his point of diversion, and quarter-mile stretches of the creek bed were dust dry. The creek's watermaster had to shut off irrigators whose rights were established as early as the 1870s to get the man his water. On Sucker Creek, as on many western streams, more water has been appropriated than exists in most years. Once the water made it to him, the landowner could dedicate it to in-stream use. The trust has since bought that right and two others on Sucker Creek, totaling 255 gallons per minute. It's entitled to defend those rights all the way to the creek's confluence with a larger stream, in this case, the East Fork of the Illinois River. In practice, says the trust's hydrologist Leslie Bach, success depends on developing a good relationship with the water masters, since they are in the field much more than she is. In a society so attuned to protecting property rights, this small change in the rules has given advocates of free-flowing water a significant lever in their battle for the veins of the watersheds. The Oregon Water Trust administers 35 water rights on 7 different river basins, targeted to bolster weak populations of salmon and steelhead, and has several more in the works. Now, if we could only get the U.S. Forest Service to allow bids on timber sales from people who want to leave the trees standing. To contact the Oregon Water Trust, they're at 111 Southwest NATO Parkway, Suite 404, Portland, Oregon, 97204. Telephone 503-226-9055. Or info@owt.org, or their website www.owt.org. Here's another good idea that someone is actually putting to work. Alex Spangler can whisk hot dishes from the washer, dart around a bulky metal shelf, and sort an armful of different-sized bowls and plates in seconds. He's the Grove Hotel's best dishwasher, his employers say, and they know that Spangler's blindness doesn't matter. In fact, the Grove Hotel has made a point of hiring the homeless, refugees, and people with disabilities. There are language barriers and physical handicaps, and it can take longer, but in the long run, it's really great, said John Mortimer, the hotel's executive chef. They're reliable, loyal employees, and they're happy to show up and do what's asked of them. With an Ada County, Idaho unemployment rate around 3.2%, employers sometimes can find top employees among people who often are overlooked, said Dwight Johnson, Idaho Department of Labor spokesman. There's no question that we're in a tight labor market in Boise, Johnson said. For someone that wants to work, if you make accommodations for their specific circumstances, I would think you would get a lot of loyalty and find a really good labor source. Spangler, 23, plans to stay on the job for a while. He's saving money to go to school and become a massage therapist. Waitresses leave dishes, already sorted, on a shelf. He rinses the dishes, feeling with his hands to make sure all the food is off before placing them on a rack and sending them through the washer. He has memorized his way around the kitchen so thoroughly that fellow employees don't immediately realize he's blind. His black Labrador guide dog, Galloway, stays in a small kennel one floor below. It's a good job, and I have good hours, Spangler said. It took some practice, but everything in the kitchen is in a certain place. Spangler's supervisor, Harold Davidson, was homeless for a year and a half before finding Mortimer at B.B. Strand's, Mortimer's former restaurant. Davidson now oversees dishwashing and is Mortimer's steward, making sure the kitchen and other areas are well stocked. I was living under a bridge, looking for work, and I knocked on his door and asked if he had any work I could do for food, Davidson said. He gave me work, and I've stayed with him since then. Mortimer got to know homeless men by dropping off food at soup kitchens and shelters, and now he does a lot of his hiring there. We tried to work with the government programs, but the bureaucracy is too time-consuming, Mortimer said. When we need help, we need it fast. 19 of the hotel's 55 maids and housekeepers are Bosnian, and they help keep the hotel's common areas and 250 guest rooms spotless. Without Bosnians, we wouldn't get this hotel cleaned, said Riley McDivitt, director of housekeeping. He also hires from Community House, the nearby homeless shelter. Housekeeping jobs pay from around $5.60 to $7.25 an hour, which can keep people off welfare. When we get busy and need somebody to work 7 days a week, they come in, McDivitt said. They treat their job with a lot of respect, and we appreciate them. Sabila Huskic, who worked in a pharmacy in Bosnia, is now a room inspector at the hotel. The war is bad. No job, no money, said Huskic, who has lived in Boise 17 months. It's a nice job, with nice people here. That's from the Idaho Statesman, daily paper in Boise, Idaho, written by Martin S. Johncox and reprinted in the Oregonian. I want to read some portions from an article about new energy technologies. This is by Gary Schwartz, and it appeared in the Permaculture Activist in September 1997. The point here is that there are some new technologies that have been invented or are close to being perfected, and sometimes they're being suppressed by the U.S. Patent Office and by corporations who would lose money if their energy-guzzling products lost in the war for competition to more energy-efficient products. First, low-power phase change technologies. A means for producing pollution-free transportation and electric power from kerosene using low-temperature phase change, LTPC, or refrigeration-based technologies was developed in the early 1970s by Wallace Minto and Archie Gay. These devices are based on a new application of refrigeration technologies. Mr. Minto had refined several generations of prototypes for powering automobiles on a closed-loop, freon-driven engine powered by a low-emissions kerosene burner. This technology was reviewed in Popular Science magazine in October 1970, where it was reported that he was negotiating with Nissan Motor Company for collaborative production of a Datsun model in 1972. Yes, the means for pollution-free transportation was on its way to market 26 years ago, as this article was written. However, Mr. Minto apparently sold the rights to his inventions to an anonymous high bidder who disappeared it. Mr. Gay had been casually collaborating with Minto and already had a $2.5 million stock offering in hand when he too was approached by a higher bidder. He refused to sell because the buyers insisted on remaining anonymous. His refusal was followed by two nearly successful attempts at murdering him and his family and sudden and contrived charges of tax fraud by the IRS. His investors withdrew their money, and his refrigerant-driven generators never made it into production. This technology surfaced again in 1978 through an American named Dennis Lee. This time the fuel source for powering the generators was not kerosene, but the thermal energy available in air, soil, or water at temperatures as low as minus 10 degrees Fahrenheit. Lee used a highly efficient heat pump married to a unique piston engine developed by Victor Fisher. There's a section here that's quite technically detailed. I'll skip that. Mr. Lee's prototypes have been tested by independent laboratories and shown to work as claimed. One would assume that such technology would be met with open arms and find widespread acceptance in the open market. However, Lee's inventions were suppressed shortly after their development when he refused to sell the rights to his technology to another anonymous but deep-pocketed purchaser. Shortly after his refusal to sell out, he was arrested, held on $1 million bail, and then sent to jail for 3 years without benefit of a trial. All this on a misdemeanor charge in the state of California for failing to file a business form. Mr. Lee assumes that this persecution was initiated and paid for by those who would stand to lose business and power by the production of independently owned, low-cost energy technologies. He is now out of jail and is once again manufacturing these pollution-free generators. His plan is to install them in homes all across the nation with a utility grid intertie. The homeowner gets free electric energy, and Mr. Lee's associates sell the excess back to the power companies. Here's a phone number for more information. Contact Steve Torma at 704-254-5613. And that number was current in September 1997. In addition to the previously mentioned inventors, George Wiseman of Eagle Research is further refining LTPC technologies for the production of electricity and for motive power in vehicles. Rather than selling a product, Mr. Wiseman sells published reports of his research on improvements to these refrigeration-based technologies. And here's an address. Eagle Research, P.O. Box 10, Yahk, that's Y-A-H-K, B.C., V0B2P0, Canada. Hydrogen power. One known means for achieving non-polluting power for transport is the combustion of hydrogen and oxygen, a process which produces energy and pure drinkable water. Hydrogen, the most abundant element in the known universe, can also produce electricity directly in a fuel cell. Hydrogen burns absolutely clean and is a fine way to store power. However, the electrolysis of water into hydrogen and oxygen still requires energy input from some other source, and the amount of energy returned from combustion is, at best, only equal to the amount of energy required for electrolysis. Intelligent hopes for hydrogen as a fuel have until recently depended on its production by electrolysis from photovoltaic or other renewable, non-polluting technologies. Dr. Randall Mills, however, has found another way to extract energy from hydrogen. He has discovered that hydrogen can be coaxed into a lower resting state than the one in which it is commonly found. And again, the article gets very technological. I won't bore you with that, but I will continue. A company, Blacklight Power Incorporated of Malvern, PA, has formed around this technology and has received a $1 million investment from PacifiCorp, the public utility company in Oregon. In addition, other domestic and foreign utility companies are negotiating terms for investment in Mills' company. There is promise of a simple hydrogen conversion for automobiles as well, an invention by Stanley Meyer, which again, I'll save you the technical details. This article continues on high-mileage carburetors for conventional engines and on Victor Schauberger's Vortex technologies, all of which is very technological. I refer you back to the article if you want to read the details. It's in the Permaculture Activist number 37 in September 1997. You might find this at your library. And I'll read the conclusion. Where are these energy miracles? Some of them may only be a good idea that almost works, and perhaps there is still considerable resistance to inexpensive power from those who rule the status quo. Whatever the cause, the majority of them have not yet arrived. There are many more inventions than space allows in this article. Paul Pantone's carburetors are available now, and Dennis Lee claims he is about to go into production of electric generators. Hopefully, we will be seeing more of these miracle machines in the marketplace soon. What can you do to help this coming energy revolution arrive sooner? Start by asking your congresspersons to increase funding for this type of research. Ask the media to give more coverage to these issues. For those who want to track these developments, a good beginning would be to read The Coming Energy Revolution by Jean Manning. Jean is spelled J-E-A-N. And High Voltage and Free Energy Devices by George Mooney, spelled M-O-O-N-H-I-E. Those with access to the Internet can start with visits to two sites. First is www.keelynet, spelled K-E-E-L-Y-N-E-T.com. And the other is the Institute for New Energy at www.padrak.com. And again, this article was written by Gary Schwartz of Asheville, North Carolina. I have read an article about a local decision to let old-growth trees grow in the Lake Tahoe area. Here's another one from California about a decision to let a river run its natural course. This is by New York Times reporter Timothy Egan, and it was picked up by the Oregonian on April 26, 1998. Napa Valley will let river run course. Napa, California. A good 64 inches of rain has pelted this valley of fine wine and pursuers of the sublime since July. So last month, in the middle of yet another El Nino-driven storm, Napa Valley residents went to the polls and decided to do something about it. By a two-thirds majority, Napa County voted to raise taxes to pay for ripping out its flood control system, allowing the near-dead Napa River to return to life and run wild for much of its 55 miles. After suffering 27 floods in less than 150 years with flood controls, the Napa Valley now will take a chance with unfettered nature. In a state where virtually every big river is shackled by a dam, pinched by levees, or siphoned for use by distant cities, the vote in Napa amounts to a call for revolution in the nation's war against high water. Under the plan, some of the old dikes and levees built to keep the river in a straight channel, largely without success, would be lowered or removed. Bridges that block the flow of high water would be raised or torn down. people living in areas that regularly flood would be bought out and asked to move. About 600 acres of low-lying land would be given back to the river as wetlands. The river's water will go where it usually goes in floods, but in the future, nobody will live there. By voting to let the river run free, reclaiming much of its own meandering path, Napa residents have also steered the Army Corps of Engineers, an agency that usually acts like the orthodontist of nature, on a new path. "What we will be doing in Napa is radically different from anything we have ever done before," said Jason Fancelo, a spokesman for the Corps in Sacramento. "It's going to totally change the way we do business." In Napa, the change is coming from voters. Three times in the past 22 years, the county has voted down Corps proposals for expanding its traditional concrete-walled flood control system. But the engineers are also undergoing a rethinking of their own. Ever since the epic Mississippi River floods in 1993, the Corps has taken a long second look at its century-old efforts to hold back flooding rivers with dams, levees, diversions, and drainage ditches. A levee system unrivaled by anything but the Great Wall of China not only has failed to keep the Mississippi between its banks, but also has made floods downriver more severe by blocking natural outlets for the rising waters. Rather than rebuilding old flooded structures, federal authorities have been buying up property in the Mississippi floodplain. But the new philosophy has yet to penetrate all of Congress, where the California delegation has been trying to get money for at least one new billion-dollar dam, nor has it been tested at the ballot box. That leaves the Napa plan as the most systematic effort in the country to try what is known as the Living Rivers approach. The existing network of braces, dikes, and levees, while protecting some people from flooding, sent so much water downstream so quickly that it always managed to spill over onto property farther downriver. The plan now is to combine ecology and engineering. Some dikes and reservoirs will be strengthened to slow the river in key places, but dredging and straightening the riverbed will be largely abandoned, and in other sections, the river will be allowed to widen during floods, filling the old marshlands south of the town of Napa. These restored wetlands will work as a sponge, the thinking goes. The cost, over 20 years, will be $220 million, half paid by the federal government and half coming from a half-cent increase in the county sales tax and from the state. To many who live in Napa, the most famous wine-growing growing region in the United States, the price is a bargain. Floods in the past 40 years have cost more than $500 million in property damage. "For over a century, we have fought a losing battle against the Napa River," city officials wrote in a voter's guide published before last month's election. "We have failed because we didn't respect the river's natural tendencies." California requires a two-thirds majority to raise a local sales tax. The vote in Napa just made that threshold, getting 68%, or 308 votes more than needed, out of more than 27,000 cast. Opponents of the measure, who did not mount an organized campaign, worried that the plan would not offer enough certainty for future years. The plan seems radical because it calls on people to trust that a raging river, if allowed to reclaim its old floodplain, ultimately will provide more protection than the existing network of levees, decades of dredging, or a plan once backed by the Corps to line the river with concrete. "It will require us to go wider instead of deeper," said Paul Bowers, the Corps of Engineers official who will co-manage the project with county authorities. "That was the biggest issue. Will people be able to give up that much land to restore the river?" Napa County officials say they will buy out several businesses, a trailer park, some warehouses, and about 16 houses. They will raise bridges that have served as blockage points to high-charging rivers. And again, that piece was by Timothy Egan of the New York Times, printed in the Oregonian, April 26, 1998. Here's an article from a wonderful magazine which apparently has gone out of print. It's called Poor Magazine, P-O-O-R, And it really is about poor people, by poor people, about their current existence and about how they try to get out of poverty. It was published in 2000. This is called Lideres Campesinas, and it's by Pamela Warwick. It has been a good year for lettuce in the Salinas Valley. Laura Caballero can feel it in her hands. The lettuce heads are so large, so heavy. When I pull them up out of the field, my hands are aching. I twist and squeeze the lettuce to fit perfectly into the box. In my fingers, they cramp sometimes. But this is nothing, nothing at all to me. I am happy now, so happy you cannot imagine. My hands may ache today, and they may ache tomorrow, but next week they will only be that much stronger. Caballero, 36, has been a farm worker in California since she was 14 and sneaked across the Mexican border to escape a father who rewarded his children's interest in reading and writing by courting them to eat their pencils and paper. She has begged for food, depended on strangers for clothing, survived beatings at home and harassment and discrimination on the job, but always, says Caballero, the pain has made her stronger. 2 weeks ago, on a steamy afternoon in Fresno, the green-eyed, auburn-haired mother of four was elected by a roomful of her peers as the first presidenta of the Farmworker Women's Leadership Project, Lideres Campesinas. The project is young and the membership still small, but for Caballero, the moment was as grand as the day she became a U.S. citizen. This is so important for me. No, I never went to school like other girls. And yes, I have much still to learn. Only now am I learning to read and write. But today I can say to the other women working in the fields, look at this. Look what we can do. It is possible. Lideres Campesinas is the first, and so far only, grassroots farm worker women's advocacy project in the nation. Since its founding in 1992, organizers have traversed the state educating women farm workers about domestic violence, pesticide poisoning, and the AIDS virus. This year, the project is also trying to boost economic independence for farm worker women. In a single year, it is not unusual for a campesina to pick cherries in Stockton, then move on to Chardonnay grapes in Sonoma, oranges in Tustin, and peaches in Porterville, without ever earning enough to eat what they pick. Although many farm workers earn the minimum wage or more, some still earn as little as $1 or $2 per hour, working on a piecemeal rate for subcontractors of big growers. It is a cruel irony, say social workers for the California Rural Legal Assistance Foundation, which, with the Family Violence Prevention Fund, helps support Lideres Campesinas, that the men and women, and often children, who put California's luscious fruits and vegetables on the nation's tables can still go hungry. Women have rights. Immigrant women, farm worker women, wives, mothers. We all have rights, but these rights have no meaning or force unless we exercise them, says Mili Trevino Sosita, Campesinas founder and director. Beyond the grapefruit orchards, past the vineyards, at the end of a sandy dirt road outside the tiny town of Coachella, a dozen women pull their folding chairs into a circle for their monthly meeting next to a farm known, fittingly, as Hope Ranch. Esperanza Sotelo, a clipboard in her hand and a toddler on her lap, tentatively calls the meeting to order in front of her battered white house trailer. We are just learning about the proper rules to run a meeting, so if I make some mistakes, please forgive me, she says softly in Spanish. Her tiny audience nods and applauds. She is a wonderful hostess, confides one of the women to a visitor. Watch what happens when the bugs come out. As the sun sets behind the stand of mesquite trees next to the trailer, Sotelo's 5-year-old daughter Eunice rushes out with an armful of plastic fly swatters. One for you, and one for you, the little girl repeats as she skips around the circle. Although there are a few newcomers, a frail teenager with a 3-year-old son, and a woman in a pale blue shift who lives in a bus with her young daughter. Many of the women are founding members of the Campesinas. Mili Trevino Sosita is here with the son she raised alone after her union organizer husband died suddenly. And so is Paula, a 58-year-old mother of three girls who spent this day, like so many days, picking table grapes in a rattlesnake-infested vineyard an hour away. After Paula's first meeting with the Campesinas, she went home and, with a baseball bat in her hands, told her abusive husband of 35 years to leave. "Until I talked to the other women, I didn't understand about domestic abuse. I didn't know there was such a thing. Growing up in Mexico, I learned the man is boss. If you don't do what he wants, then you must pay the price. But it was getting worse and worse for me at home. Even my children, who are almost grown now, were disrespectful of me. So, finally, after all these years, I said, enough. Three times he has tried to come back," says Paula, "and three times I got the bat and he went away. This was a good lesson, not just for him and even for me, but for my daughters. Now, they see, women don't have to take this." Trevino Sosita, who began working in the fields with her family when she was 8, was already involved in union organizing in the early 1990s when she agreed to help a graduate student gather information for a thesis on problems facing farm worker women. "The stories we heard were not so different from Paula's and Laura's," recalls Trevino Sosita. They all reflected this belief that the job of women is to obey the men at home, the crew leaders in the field, all the men are to be obeyed, no matter what. Going door to door with questionnaires, they found women unable to read or write in Spanish, let alone English. They found women who had been beaten and humiliated. Each woman who poured out her story, with tears or anger, or, more often, resignation, believed she was alone in her pain. "The message we came back with," says Trevino Sosita, "is the message we are trying to spread now among the thousands of women who need to hear it. It is up to us to take control of our lives." At the meeting outside of the Sotela trailer, the subject is pesticide poisoning at some farms where the women have worked. "We have so many rashes, and our eyes are so burning and red sometimes. We need to know, what is in the spray California growers use on the fields? But even when we ask, sometimes they don't tell us," says Sotelo, who has helped other workers find health clinics to treat their mysterious illnesses. "We cough and itch our skin and rub our eyes, but the clinics say they don't know. Maybe it's flu or something," Sotelo sighs. According to the state's Department of Pesticide Regulation, there has been a dramatic drop in the number of pesticide-related illnesses throughout California in the last decade. Growers have supported requirements to train and educate farm workers about the dangers of exposure. According to federal immigration estimates, women and their children represent a growing share of the 100,000 to 300,000 undocumented immigrant workers entering the U.S. each year. But the women are less likely than the men to speak English and therefore more at risk for exploitation, more often working below minimum wage, and more often the subjects of sexual harassment and threats of deportation. Because of the language barrier, women farm workers tend to be almost invisible in our society, although their special problems are dramatic and often life-threatening, says the Campesinas Trevino Sosita. "The problems are compounded by the cultural reluctance to speak out, to complain about their lot in life. Although family violence is a problem that cuts across racial and ethnic lines, organizations such as the Family Violence Prevention Fund singled out the Campesinas Project for its prestigious 1995 Marshall's Domestic Peace Prize because it is the only program of its kind that specifically targets Spanish-speaking farm worker women. Julia Medina, 60, is retired now, permanently disabled from a lifetime of working in the fields. But that, she says, makes her an enthusiastic ambassador for the Campesinas Project. "I joined at the beginning. Mili came to my home in Merced and told me about what she and the others hoped to do about domestic violence in our community. Because of the poverty and the alcohol and the epidemic of abuse against women and children, I was anxious to help. In Merced, where many farm worker families live in their cars, sleep in boxes under bridges, or in makeshift huts, she didn't have to wait long for her opportunity. Within weeks, she was personally escorting battered women to shelters and helping women file police reports against abusive partners. I try to let people know there is help out there, but sometimes you have to ask, Medina says. After months of trying unsuccessfully to persuade a close friend to leave her violent husband, the neighbor finally appeared, bloodied and bruised, on her doorstep last March. Now I'm ready, she told Medina, who called police. It's Saturday night, but Laura Caballero is just returning home from the fields near Porterville, where she packs lettuce 10 hours a day, 6 days a week. This Saturday, like many weekends, her four sons, aged 14 to 19, are with her. I want them to see what people do to get the food on the table. I want them to see how hard we work, how hard I work, so they will know and they will understand. I am still in the fields, and that is where I reach the women. I could leave the fields, but I will not, not now. The women I work with say, you understand. You are my friend. If you leave the fields, you forget. If you stay here, you will never forget. What began in Mili Trevino Sosita's Pomona kitchen with a few small grants and a handful of women with a dream today has a $200,000 annual budget with major grants from the Federal Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and several large private foundations. Although we need money to get our message to so many women who need to hear it, the great thing about how we work, says founder Trevino Sosita, is that we rely on ourselves ultimately. When we get together, we stay at each other's houses, we make our own meals, we ride together, and help each other with child care. We are empowering ourselves and sharing our power with others. The money just helps us do it better and for more people. But if we have to, we can live on nothing. We know that because every one of us has done it. If you'd like to learn more about this organization, or help, or start a similar organization where you live, you can contact Mili Trevino Sosita at 909-865-7776. And that number was current in 2000. Trevino Sosita. It's spelled Trevino hyphen Sauceda. Address is 611.